Times on Radio Row at the Democratic National Convention in South Philadelphia. We're going to take a break from today's presidential campaign to turn the clock back to 1968, when Robert Kennedy was one of the Democrats running for president. The country was at war. Racial tensions were high, especially after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and it felt as if the future of the country was at stake, was on the line. Our guest Larry Tai is the author of a new book called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Kennedy was a man of contradictions who began his career working for the red-baiting Senator Joe McCarthy and ending his career calling for racial healing and progressive policies. And then he was assassinated when he was just 42 years old. Larry Tai joins us from the studios of WHYY. He's an award-winning journalist at the Boston Globe. He now runs a Boston-based training program for medical journalists. And Larry Tai, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
So let's turn that clock back to 1968. But first of all, what are some of the parallels that you see between 1968 and today, 2016?
So I think the parallels are really striking. Part of the parallel is just what you said in your introduction, that it was a time of racial tension. It was a time of international tension. It was a time when Americans were looking for direction and looking for somebody to bring the country together. And the question is the parallel there as well with candidates today who can do the kind of bridge building that Bobby Kennedy seemed on the verge of doing back in 1968?
Would he today be called a flip-flopper? I mean, this is a man, as you write and as we look at his life and his career, who really, I won't say made a right-hand turn, but really, quote-unquote, evolved on so many different issues.
So you're polite. He would not only be called a flip-flopper, he would be dismissed.
He was a flip-flopper,
he would be dismissed as one. And yet, I think he had as profound and real a transformation, a change of heart. And I don't know a whole lot about religion and about transformations, but I think we all want to believe in redemption, and Bobby Kennedy really did change. He changed by going against the political winds, so that's sort of the opposite of flip-flopping. And by the end, he was somebody very different and I think a whole lot more interesting than he started out as.
What was his relationship with the press? Of course, this is, what, 50 years ago?
Can't it is, do that 48 quick math. Years ago.
48 years ago, yeah. What was his relationship with the press?
So I think that's another area where it's instructive for today. He started out the 1968 campaign with as ham-handed an entry as anybody could imagine. He basically announced his entry into the campaign 4 days after Senator Eugene McCarthy from Minnesota had beat LBJ in the New Hampshire primary, and a famous columnist wrote to Ted Kennedy saying, "Your brother has proved that St. Patrick didn't drive all the snakes out of Ireland."
Wow.
Now, that was as much of a put-down as you can imagine. The press started out thinking he was an opportunist, started out really cynical about him, and yet over the time from that time in the beginning of winter of 68 to the time that he was killed in June, there was a transformation. And a transformation, I think, measured by one reporter, a guy named Richard Harwood for the Washington Post. And Ben Bradley named Richard Harwood to be his campaign reporter covering Bobby Kennedy in 68 because he knew that Harwood was a hard-edged ex-Marine. And he knew that Harwood really didn't like Bobby Kennedy. They had played touch football together. Harwood came away bloodied and thought that Bobby Kennedy broke all the rules. So he started out as a cynic, and that was what Bradley wanted. By the end of the campaign, he had turned around to the point where he begged Bradley to take him off, saying, "I've fallen in love with a candidate." And that was the kind of impact he had that's so different from today's Donald Trump bash and banish and today's Hillary Clinton, which is duck and parry with the press.
You mentioned Eugene McCarthy. Was he the Bernie Sanders of his day?
He was. I think that Bobby Kennedy was actually something himself between Bernie Sanders. He was even more radical than Bernie Sanders in some ways, and Hillary Clinton, the ultimate practical, pragmatic, experienced politician. And that was what was brilliant about him. He seemed to bring together the two wings of the Democratic Party.
I was a college student in 1968, and I do remember kind of realizing something about Robert Kennedy that I didn't see in his brother, John Kennedy, and I didn't really notice about him while he was the Attorney General and part of this very wealthy, well-connected family from Massachusetts.
Yes. So if they had gone into the priesthood the way Rose Kennedy dreamed that one of her sons would, John Kennedy would have been the Pope. He was the guy who sort of stood above things, intellectual, removed. Bobby Kennedy would have been a parish priest. He was grassroots, he was down in the dirt, and that's the way he learned. And I think they were incredibly different people and would have had incredibly different presidencies. Bobby was a whole lot more provocative and passionate, and I think from day one, rather than his brother's caution, he would have been out there trying to do some pretty dramatic change kinds of things.
And I do want to play a clip. I know, Larry, you've heard this a lot as you've been talking about your book. And this is, of course, Robert Kennedy after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. But let me just ask you about his evolution on race. How did that happen?
So he started out not quite clueless, but not a whole lot more advanced than that in terms of race issues. He grew up in the almost lily-white worlds of Cape Cod and Palm Beach, and he hadn't had a whole lot of experience. And in the early years as Attorney General, when things like the Freedom Riders, these young whites and blacks who were going through the South trying to integrate interstate transportation and the bus terminals, when they were demonstrating in places like Anniston, Alabama, and Birmingham and Montgomery, Bobby Kennedy was telling them to slow down. He didn't want it to embarrass his brother, who was having a summit with Nikita Khrushchev. So he started out clueless. He learned over time. And by the end of his tenure as Attorney General, he was out there calling in federal troops to integrate schools like the University of Alabama. And by the end of his life, I think it's not hyperbole to say he was the most trusted white man in black America.
Well, let me play a clip. It's a famous clip, and I have to say I listened to it again in preparation for the show, and it just gave me chills. And again, this is Robert F. Kennedy. He's telling a crowd about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. This is April 4th, 1968. He's in Indianapolis, Indiana. And let's give it a listen, and then we'll talk to Larry Tye.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country, in greater polarization, black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love.
Wow, such a powerful thing coming from Robert Kennedy. And again, Larry Tye, I know you've heard that a lot, but one can't help but feel the relevance of those words today.
So can I give you just a really quick story about the background of the speech?
Of course.
So Bobby Kennedy that night had arrived. He was contesting his first primary in the state of Indiana, and he had arrived in Indianapolis to hear that Martin Luther King had been killed. The mayor, who went on to become a powerful U.S. senator named Richard Lugar, said, "You will not go into your rally in the middle of the African-American ghetto tonight." Bobby Kennedy listened to that advice. He ignored it. He went into the ghetto, stood up on the back of a flatbed truck, delivered 5 minutes of unrehearsed, pitch-perfect remarks. And it was, you don't have to trust me that it had an impact on that crowd. Of more than 100 cities in America that night of Martin Luther King's death that had riots, any city essentially with a large African-American community had a riot. The one exception was Indianapolis, and that, I think, was because of Bobby Kennedy. And those are precisely the words and the tone that I think Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and Barack Obama have struggled and been less successful in finding to address what's happened in Dallas and Baton Rouge and St. Paul. Bobby Kennedy managed to do it that night, partly because he opened himself up for the first time ever to talk about his brother Jack's death, and partly because over the last 20 years, he had been learning and been able to empathize with what the people in that community were going through. And he was such a credible voice. And the one who recognized his credibility more than anyone at an early point happened to be Martin Luther King Jr.
Oh, that's so interesting. You also write, Larry, that and we should remember this, there was no Secret Service protection for, I guess, what, candidates running for office. And he was known for essentially wading into crowds of people and supporters and perhaps even protesters and critics.
He had one ex-FBI agent who was his entire security detail. And it wasn't until after his death that LBJ issued an executive order saying candidates need Secret Service protection. Bobby Kennedy knew that he was vulnerable. He had always said that he assumed it would be him and not Jack if anybody in the family was ever targeted. And the tragic sense of foreboding that he had played itself out that night in California.
And, you know, it's so easy, about a minute or so before our break here, but it's, you know, it's so easy to kind of speculate if he had not been assassinated, which, of course, he was, would he have been able to beat Richard Nixon? Would he have become the president of the United States? We don't know this, but, Larry, what are your thoughts about that?
So since nobody can prove me wrong, I'm totally
exactly.
convinced he would have been the Democratic nominee, and there was nobody in America who understood Richard Nixon's vulnerabilities better than the guy who had run his brother's successful campaign against Nixon 8 years before. So I think he would have been the president.
And who had worked for Joe McCarthy.
And who had worked for Joe McCarthy, absolutely.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Taking a bit of a break from the 2016 presidential race, talking with Larry Tye about his book called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. And you can hear we're on Radio Row. There's a lot of hubbub, people practicing for tonight's events here at the Wells Fargo Center. I should add that President Obama is speaking tonight. And you can join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Staying with Larry Tye, we've got some other guests who'll be stopping by and a couple of really cool things we've got waiting for you after the break. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times on Radio Row. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Larry Tye. He's an award-winning journalist at the Boston Globe. He runs a Boston-based training program for medical journalists, and we are talking about a book that he has written about Bobby Kennedy, and I should add that he is speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Free Library of Philadelphia, the book called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Larry, how did Bobby Kennedy get involved in politics? And I know he got this job with Joe McCarthy, sounds like with the help of his dad.
So he got involved in politics by being born Joe Kennedy's son.
Right.
And Joe Kennedy had initially dreamed that he would be the president, only he turned out to be something of a Nazi appeaser during the start of World War II. And that ruled him out. He was fired by FDR. And at that moment that he realized he couldn't do it, he had this notion that his sons would take over that grand vision of becoming president. And first it was Joe Jr., who was killed in a tragic plane accident, a heroic mission to try to take out German V-2 bombers. The day Joe Jr. died, the mantle fell to Jack. And Bobby had been content to be the behind-the-scenes guy for Jack for all the years through his service as Attorney General. But the day that Jack died, Bobby knew, even though it took him a while to acknowledge it, that the mantle was his. And he turned out also, by the way, to be the most like his father in terms of really knowing how, behind the scenes and in front of the scenes, to get things done.
How much of an anti-communist was he, and did he support Joe McCarthy?
So he, like much of America in the 1950s, was an anti-communist. He said that Joe McCarthy was the only politician in Washington with the courage to stand up and root out communists, who McCarthy saw behind every pillar of the State Department. And Bobby Kennedy believed in Joe McCarthy. He believed in doing things that his dad believed in, and his dad believed in McCarthy. So it was, in a way, as much as it looks like a contradiction today, it was a natural thing for him to go to work for McCarthy shortly after he graduated from law school.
Now, I think we would call this nepotism. Perhaps it was called nepotism when he became his brother's attorney general and, of course, went on to basically be his, what, chief of staff?
So it was called nepotism. It might also be called chutzpah because he was appointed attorney general, never having tried a case. There may have never been an attorney general who was appointed with fewer obvious qualifications. And yet, by the end of his tenure, people could make a strong case that he was the best attorney general in modern American history, if not in American history.
What was their relationship like when they worked so closely together? And, growing up at that time, there were all those photos of them thinking together, talking together, perusing things together.
So the way Ethel, Bobby's widow, described it was, it wasn't only that they could finish one another's sentences, it was that they almost didn't have to use words at all. There was such a sense of having a feel for what one another wanted, which is why, in addition to being his attorney general, Bobby Kennedy was Jack's pseudo CIA chief. He was a guy he turned to, that Jack Kennedy turned to more often than the Secretary of State for advice on international issues. He ran on Jack's behalf a secret war against Cuba. He was a critical advisor during the missile crisis. He was probably the closest thing we have to something we're perpetually calling but never really seeing in a co-presidency.
And an enforcer for his brother as well, would that be fair to say?
Hugely an enforcer. He was the, and I'll mispronounce the word, he was his consigliere. He was his lieutenant. He was the guy who did the tough things. When somebody had to cover up Jack Kennedy's adrenal condition called Addison's disease, it was Bobby who did it. When somebody had to make a phone call behind the scenes at the very end of the 1960 campaign to get Martin Luther King out of jail, a phone call that probably helped turn that election in Jack Kennedy's favor, it was Bobby Kennedy who did it. He was somebody who did things and then denied having done them that were quite extraordinary.
Which, of course, raises the obvious question about just how someone like that would be viewed today when it feels like there's kind of a purity test, at least for some candidates.
So he'd either be viewed by some people as the ultimate hard-edged realist that they want to see in the White House, or by others as somebody who was untrustworthy and had done all these bad things. And I think there were two Bobby Kennedys. There was the one who started out in those early years of the 1950s reflecting America back then. He was much tougher than tender. And then there was the Bobby Kennedy post-assassination where the dial switched. He became more empathetic. He realized that in one assassin's bullet, he could lose his brother, his best friend, and his whole sense of purpose. And Bobby Kennedy started becoming more empathetic and tender then. So he gave us everything that we all want in a presidential candidate, both sides in one guy.
You mentioned Ethel Kennedy, and she spoke to you for this book. Was it hard to convince her to do that?
So I'd like to tell you that I was a charismatic guy who went to her doorstep and she couldn't not talk to me. I think it was that she was turning 88 years old. She was sensing her mortality, and I happened to be the guy who turned up then, and she was incredibly generous. I thought she would kick me out after 15 minutes of our interview. The first interview was a couple hours. The second one was equally long, and she was wonderful.
And told you things you didn't know?
told me things, let me test out every theory I had on Bobby Kennedy. When I tried to understand how Bobby could be friends with Joe McCarthy, she said much of America may have thought of him as a monster. To us, he was the guy who came and totally charmed our oldest child, Kathleen, who was a toddler then, and he was a human being to them. He was a friend to them. And on that and everything else, she helped peel away the Kennedy myth-making machine and let me see Bobby.
I'm looking at a couple of comments here. One from Ike says, I was listening to the Kennedy announcement that I actually heard back in 1968 when I was at Morehouse, my alma mater. Wow. And were you alive, Larry, in 1968? I'm down here. You're up there. So I don't even know what you look like.
So we look a lot alike. You look a lot younger than I am, but we're about the same age. And I think that
we're boomers, right? We're boomers.
We are absolutely boomers. And we were people who, with your time, Summers, in Cape Cod, who understood the way being in Massachusetts, you were infused with this sense of the Kennedys. And in 1968, what I didn't know, and I didn't know actually until I was writing this book, is as much as Bobby looked totally opportunistic to come in and announce his candidacy 4 days after the New Hampshire primary, he had in fact determined to run 8 days before. He wanted to give Gene McCarthy a clean swipe at LBJ. And by doing that, he sort of started his campaign on exactly the wrong foot. But then, as every time, he managed to recover.
That's Larry Tai. We're talking about his new book. It's called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Doing some comparisons between 1968 and today, 2016. Of course, Kennedy running for the Democratic nomination for president. He was assassinated. He was just 42 years old. And Larry Tai talking about this man of contradictions, a man of deep passions, and, of course, a very famous family, the Kennedy family. And, again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. When I was reading your book, Larry, a reminder that Robert Kennedy died just 42 years old, and maybe that just shows you how old I am, but it just seems so young. And of course, this was on the heels of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.
So can I tell you what John Lewis, the wonderful congressman from Georgia, said when I talked to him about Bobby Kennedy's death? He was a protege of Martin Luther King's, and he said when Martin Luther King died in April of that year, he was devastated, but he thought, at least we have Bobby. A couple months later, when Bobby Kennedy was killed, he thought, we have nothing, and he basically lay on his bed and sobbed. And I think there was a sense that this was not just Jack Kennedy's younger brother, it was America's younger brother. And that image of this young-looking Bobby Kennedy at age 42 defies logic when I think that this year, last November, Bobby would have turned 90.
Wow, 90 years old. Is there, though, the temptation to mythologize him? I know your book is trying to address that, but just the fact that he was young, charismatic, had these some incredible speeches later on in his life that we're going to put him on a pedestal where maybe he doesn't belong?
So I think my book tried to knock down the pedestal, but by the end, he had to be back up there because I think he deserves this sense. He is the tough liberal or tender conservative that we've been looking for, and that's why Bill Clinton, in a magical moment in his speech last night, referred to Bobby Kennedy. And you could almost hear in that convention center the ahs. All he had to do was say Bobby Kennedy's name.
And how much of this convention have you been watching and taking in?
Enough to know that I think that Hillary Clinton, if there's anybody, so her husband's model was Jack Kennedy. My guess is if we were to ask Hillary Clinton to pick one person from the past who she would like to model herself after, it would be Bobby Kennedy. And I think she is trying to be that agent of change. That was what last night's talks were all about. And I think that she's trying to channel the sense of somebody who gave the potential of building a coalition that we've never seen, a coalition of blue-collar whites, of blacks, of Hispanics, the kind of response to the divisiveness of this year's campaign that the model from 50 years ago addresses.
She describes herself in many ways as a pragmatic progressive. Do you see Robert Kennedy that way?
Absolutely. There was nobody who understood better the dark side of American politics, nobody who understood how to pragmatically get things done like him, and yet the crusader that we remember, he was a visionary at the same time he was a pragmatist. And what a brilliant combination. If you have somebody with a vision but also knows how to get that done, and who knows, with Bobby Kennedy, because he died so young, I can say anything that he would have gotten done. He would have solved our race problems. He would have gotten us out of the war. All of those things are believable because we don't know, but he wanted to try.
It's interesting to talk about a visionary in 2016 when it seems that everyone is just so cynical. There's a lot of suspicion about public figures, about public institutions, members of Congress, whoever is sitting in the White House. It's just interesting to think about how people thought about politics and even the Kennedys back then, not that everyone loved them, but to put that into today's context.
Absolutely. So Jules Feiffer, the brilliant New Yorker cartoonist, did a cartoon that he called The Bobby Twins, and it was talking about the good Bobby and the bad Bobby. The good Bobby was the one who appointed a lot of racist judges. The bad Bobby was the most trusted white man in black America. He talked about these different sides of him, and I think that anybody who followed that campaign by the end in 1968 would have said Bobby had overcome the bad Bobby and become mainly the good Bobby. And I think that is precisely the challenge that the good Hillary and the bad Hillary face today.
How would you describe the good Hillary and the bad Hillary?
So the bad Hillary is the one who gets into all these scandals with emails and who takes all this money from Wall Street and then denies having taken it. The good Hillary is the one we heard her husband describe last night, the agent of change who's been pushing for things that affect real people around the world for most of her life. And they're trying to give us the vision of the good Hillary in this convention, and I think it's up to her Thursday night and up to her through the rest of the campaign to make us believe in the good Hillary.
Let me read an email from Rob. He said, I was watching a special on CNN about the presidential race between JFK and Nixon and was interested to learn that not only was the Democratic Party not really in the civil rights movement camp, but when Martin Luther King got arrested and JFK ultimately called King's wife, Bobby was furious with him because he thought they would lose the Southern white votes. He ultimately used it to JFK's advantage, but for political reasons, not for moral reasons. Larry, can you speak to that?
So I can. That was the official version that we got, and that's the story that we told, that JFK makes the phone call. Martin Luther King has been jailed in Georgia, and JFK makes a very sympathetic phone call to Coretta King saying, I feel badly for you. Bobby, in fact, not only wasn't outraged, Bobby Kennedy was making his own behind-the-scenes phone call that we didn't learn about for decades later, and that was a phone call that any lawyer in your listening audience would know probably breached the borders of ethics. He called the sentencing judge and he said, can you release Martin Luther King? The judge said, I absolutely can. Bobby said, come visit the White House someday when we're in it. That Sunday, in black churches across America, leaflets were handed out describing the candidate without a heart, who was Richard Nixon, and the candidate with a heart, who was Jack Kennedy, who helped get Martin Luther King out of jail. Teddy White, the great chronicler of elections back then, says it was the black vote in five or six key states that gave Jack Kennedy his margin of victory, that all Nixon had to do was get the same percentage of the African-American vote that Dwight Eisenhower had gotten 4 years before, and he would have been in the White House. So those phone calls happened. Bobby Kennedy orchestrated it. It was the perfect behind-the-scenes operation, and it got his brother elected president.
Well, going back to 1968, as we know, Richard Nixon won the election. Eugene McCarthy lost badly. Do you see the sort of perhaps wounds that the Democratic Party experienced that year? Do you see them today?
We see them very much today. We see the wounds of the candidate who stayed above the fray and never entered a primary, Hubert Humphrey, coming in and the establishment figures making him the nominee. We see McCarthy. We see shades of Bernie Sanders and what McCarthy did that year. I like to think that the one candidate who could have pulled together those two wings of the party to be a nominee, if Hubert Humphrey came within a whisker of beating Richard Nixon with all the baggage Humphrey was carrying, right, the true alternative, Bobby Kennedy, would have offered a compelling alternative.
How long did it take you to write this book, Larry?
Longer than I've ever spent on anything, which was
really?
Maybe 3 years. Yeah.
Really? Really? And you wrote a book called Satchel. You've written a number of books as well. Why was this harder to write, or just required more background on your part?
Because there were more than 400 people to interview, because I was in a race against age. His contemporaries were nearly as old as Bobby, and against senility. I wanted to get to them while they were still alive and had memory. There were so many people to talk to. There had been so much written and said about Bobby. And the last reason, and the most compelling, is that it was so much fun that I didn't want it to end.
Oh, really? I mean, this is not the first book about Robert Kennedy. Did you feel some degree of competition with what had been written?
I felt like I was competing with history. I felt like I was competing with people who were out there doing similar books. And yet, in the end, I felt like I was competing with myself to try to, on the one hand, be fair to him and yet hard enough on him, and to give a sense of somebody who had made a transformation that was a lens into how America was changing from the 50s to the 60s. Bobby Kennedy was an indication of how America was changing for the better. And I think, therefore, he was a bigger story. This was a bigger story than just about Bobby Kennedy. It was a story about America at mid-century.
Do you love Bobby Kennedy?
I started out loving him. In the middle of the book, I wasn't sure. And by the end, he became a flesh and blood hero, and I love him even more than I did.
Well, Larry Tye, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times from WHYY in Center City, Philadelphia.
Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. And the book is called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. And you can catch up with our guest. He's speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia at 7:30. Larry Tye, an award-winning journalist at the Boston Globe. He runs a Boston-based training program for medical journalists. We're going to take a very short break. We'll get back to Radio Times here on Radio Times Row. We have two guests sitting across from me. We'll be talking about political memorabilia. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Radio Times on Radio Row at the Democratic National Convention here in South Philadelphia at the Wells Fargo Center. This is our fourth day on Radio Row. We've got one more day, then we'll be back at WHYY. Well, if there's a political campaign, there's going to be memorabilia, signs and buttons, bumper stickers, T-shirts, and, of course, those silly hats. There's plenty of memorabilia at the DNC, including some anti-Hillary memorabilia. Our guests, curators John Grinspan and Lisa Kathleen Grady, are snatching up some of the most important items for the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, and they have stopped by to do a bit of show and tell. John Grinspan, a curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, in fact, was a guest on Radio Times talking about his most recent book called The Virgin Vote. And John, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
That's great to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you here. And again, Lisa Kathleen Grady, deputy chair and curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. And Lisa, nice to have you with us as well.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. So do you have some good swag that you found here in Philadelphia, John?
Yeah, we're finding great stuff. We're finding historical objects. You have to imagine in 100 years, not knowing anything about this election, walking into a museum, what could you see that would explain what's going on today in 2016?
Now, it's a little weird to do show and tell on the radio. This is just for us here. Obviously, we'll do some descriptions, but you have some signs there.
What
next
I have,
to you. What do you have there, Lisa?
What I have today are signs. One of the things we do is scavenge, and this was a really hard sign yesterday. This is the Changemaker sign.
Changemaker.
That came up while former President Clinton was speaking about his wife. And this has become, and I think is going to become, one of the iconic, it's now one of the catchphrases, and is going to be one of the iconic signs of this campaign.
Did you snatch that out of someone's hands, or was it lying on the floor?
I did ask a couple of people if I could have a sign. No, the very nice people who are helping out with signs, or creating the signs, saved one for me.
What else? Yeah, go ahead, John.
It does become a little bit of a video game walking around here. You see somebody walk by with an amazing hat or sign, and
yes,
you chase them down.
Can I have it?
Yes, exactly. You have to sweet talk your way into getting it.
What else do you have there?
these are some of the handmade signs that they have out. And I love this one. I like the checklist I did. I'm sorry, this is for Hillary Clinton, and it's a checklist of credentials. First Lady, Senator, Secretary of State, Experience, President, soon President. With all the boxes checked, and President soon to come. And then on the back, it's backed with Bill Clinton for First Lady.
That's great.
Which is, of course, one of the odder questions we get frequently. Who will be the First Lady, and what will he or she be called?
You, I assume, John, were in Cleveland last week. So what were some of the, handmade signs that you found there?
Oh, there are a lot. You see a real back and forth in the signs, even between Cleveland and Philadelphia. For instance, we saw coal and energy symbols there, and we see climate change stuff here. You can see real debates over policy and the history and the place of America playing out through objects and through signs, and that's always exciting. These two, Cleveland and Philadelphia, are talking to each other right now.
Have you also seen in both of these cities the kind of locker up that we have heard from some of the protesters here in Philadelphia? And that was certainly what New Jersey Governor Chris Christie got the audience to chant when he was in Cleveland.
There was a lot of chanting from the floor. There were people on, there were signs with that kind of language on the floor. There was actually a gentleman on the floor, one of the delegates. I'm sure it got on camera somewhere, created a Hillary Clinton mask and was wearing an orange prison outfit with plastic handcuffs and was walking around doing photo ops. So there's, I think on both conventions, people are really acting out as well as holding their opinions for this campaign. It's a very passionate campaign.
Certainly you have the memorabilia that's given out by the conventions, I guess, by the parties, by the candidates, and then you have this more sort of homemade DIY kind of campaign memorabilia.
Yeah, and I think, I don't want to speak for both of us, but we love that stuff best in a way, because it really shows that there was an individual involved and active, engaged, made a sign, either came here or protested at City Hall or Public Square in Cleveland, went out into the streets and made a physical object, and that in 100 years' time, we'll say not just that they're big campaign machines, but they're individuals behind them.
How far back do you go at the Smithsonian for the first piece of campaign memorabilia? I know there's a G.W. George Washington pin. Is that the first?
We consider it the start of the campaign collection. Obviously, George Washington did not run for president, but that inaugural button is what we consider to be the start. It's also a fantastic, also inaugural banner. That's periodically seen on exhibit because at this point it's fragile and we're trying to eke out its life. But it's a crayon portrait of Thomas Jefferson on linen with an eagle. And the eagle is holding ribbons. One of them says, Thomas Jefferson, President of the United States. And the other says, John Adams is no more. So we like to stress the point that this is not new.
Right. This is definitely not new. You mentioned hats. Is there a time when the hats that we associate with campaigns became popular, John?
Well, there used to be campaign hats for marchers. So people would have kind of militaristic hats that they would wear when they marched with torchlight processions at midnight down Spruce Street or whatever, down Main Streets in American cities. It's not till the 20th century that you really see these homemade kind of kooky hats.
And we have this image of the donkey and the elephant. That's how, you know, the Republicans are the elephant, the Democrats are the donkey. But that wasn't always the case.
There have been different symbols for both parties over time, and the elephant and the donkey really started solidifying later and have become the real mascots of the two parties. And I don't know if it's because they're fun to draw, but and it's interesting how you see them in everything from cuddly toys to very fearsome elephants and donkeys battling. So you can do a lot with those symbols.
And it's funny, they used to really signify something, that when they were introduced in the 1870s, the Republican Party is very large but kind of clumsy. And so people see an elephant as this massive thing that, you know, steps all over things. The Democratic Party is seen as small and scrappy and kind of stubborn. So a donkey is that symbol. And they were almost insults for a while.
I was going to say, that sounds kind of insulting in a way.
It came from political cartoons, people making fun of these parties that were seen as ridiculous and similar to ways today, almost a negative force in American democracy in the 1870s. And they got won over and became pacified in a way over time.
Yeah, but sort of appropriating it and using it for their own ends.
And you see that in memorabilia. You look at the material from the William Henry Harrison campaign. And that's the idea, was that they were hurling an insult, that if you gave him enough money, he's so lazy, he'll just go sit in a log cabin and drink hard cider. And instead of being beaten down by that, they seized it, made it an amazing campaign icon, and there's everything from parade pieces to China with the image of log cabin and hard cider. And yeah, we still quote that as a campaign slogan.
He didn't stay very long in office. Didn't, what is it, 32 days?
Or something
before, 31 days before he died. I was looking at some of what you've written. Before the elephants and donkeys, some of the other animals, I guess, that have been featured in campaigns, raccoons and roosters.
Yeah, raccoons, roosters, foxes, all sorts of different symbols. I mean, there have been so many parties over American history that all need their own symbol. The first party that had a convention was the Anti-Mason Party. They didn't hang around long enough even to get an animal. So I guess you need to be a really established party to get your own raccoon animal.
Yeah. But it is interesting to pick an animal. I mean, I guess in certain ways it humanizes a party.
You can give it a face. You can anthropomorphize it. Anything you can anthropomorphize in some way, people will start to identify with. Although I still don't understand Billy Possum. Oh, the idea of choosing a possum.
Yeah, I don't know.
Here's a Facebook comment from James. I laugh every time I see an old bumper sticker with a losing candidate, McCain Palin, 2008, the original Maverick. And it is true, these things do live on, sometimes on people's bumpers, and eventually fade over time. But it is interesting. And bumper stickers, did that come with cars? Or what? At what point do we begin to see that? Do you know?
I knew this a few days ago because we pulled one out to look at. Bumper stickers.
We're going to Google that for you.
I'm going to be wrong no matter what I say. I want to say that window stickers are in the 20s and 30s, and they're more paper. And I want to say that the bumper stickers that we're used to start coming out in the 50s. But I'm not. No, that's not true. In the 30s, but I'm not entirely sure about that.
You have information about gold water, Johnson juice. When are we going to get Trump steaks? I mean, talking about the kind of food angle here.
Well, Trump has been merchandising and branding for a long time, so I think there's a lot of objects to collect over time to demonstrate Trump is such a presence that no matter what happens with this election throughout history, people will be studying him, and there's a lot of symbols to go with that.
We just throw a computer face at you. You anything you want to add, Lisa?
They were checking my date.
So just to make sure everything is all
so, yeah, in the 30s, they started putting it, as I remember, on paper, and you couldn't affix it. You would put it in and sort of have it in a windshield, and then they became adhesive later.
Well, just about a minute before we have to say goodbye to you. Anything you're on the hunt for, John? Mm-hmm. A couple more days to go before all this is over.
I always like the back and forth. At the RNC in Cleveland, we saw a real debate between protesters and convention objects about whether America was great or whether America never was great. Real back and forth. And we're looking for those debates here. And you can see them, protesters, you can see them in the convention. This is a vibrant election, more vibrant than we've had in a while in many ways. And so preserving that for posterity is very important.
And very briefly, Lisa, what did you think of Michelle Obama's dress on Monday night?
You know, I was in the cheap seats, but it seemed like a lovely dress.
Well, we're going to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for stopping by Radio Row and talking to us about all the swag and memorabilia that you're collecting from the 2016 election. So thanks so much.
Great. Thank you.
Nice to have you both with us. John Grinspan and Lisa Kathleen Grady from the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. And we are listening to singers preparing for tonight. Well, Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler turned on her recorder earlier this morning when she arrived at the Wells Fargo Center. Here's her behind-the-scenes look at what happens long before the speakers take to the stage.
I'm here outside AT&T subway station where just a few hours ago there were loud, noisy protesters making their case. It's pretty quiet right now. There's an airplane, the sound of a helicopter, security personnel, police stationed on every corner. Two members of the event staff just passed me, and one woman was complaining that when she worked last night, she was stationed in an area that had no toilet. So that's what people are talking about here. It's still early. Everyone looks a little bleary-eyed. I got some warm smiles from the cops, and we are about to go in. All right. I am now in Wells Fargo, and let's walk out into the actual convention area. And I think that gives you a pretty good idea. It's so quiet you can hear. I don't know if it's the lights or the HVAC unit. It's something. It is not delegates chanting and speakers up on the podium delivering a speech. It is quiet here. It's not even 8 a.m. One way to tell if Frank and his fellow maintenance workers here at the Wells Fargo Center are nearby is if you hear this sound. He's pushing a huge plastic bucket. I'm not sure what the word is. Picking up trash at every bathroom, another station, checking it. You got a broom and a pan here.
Sweeping around the bathrooms, making sure the bathroom's clean and all that stuff, you know.
Picking up the trash from the trash cans.
In the trash can, mopping the floors, whatever, you know. Whatever it spills, whatever people spill stuff around here, we clean it up, you know what I mean, for nobody to get hurt around in the facilities. We doing our job and everything, you know what I mean? And, you know, it's a good place to work at for now, you know what I mean? Be honest with you. I'm just hoping, like, the priest of the, supposed to go up $15 an hour. I hope it'll go up real soon for anybody, you know?
Right now you're making less than 15?
I'm making, like, $9.26.
Do you usually work here at Wells Fargo? You work Sixers games, Flyers games?
Yes, I work here all the time, season, yes. I've been here going almost 5 years.
Wow, and I see you have a Sixers lanyard. Is it different working this convention compared to, like, you know, a sports game, compared to a Sixers game? Is your job different?
Not really. It's about the same almost, you know what I mean, what we do every day, like pour the trash and all that stuff, clean the floors and all that, you know, build the service, you know what I mean? So when they call us, we be on point, you know what I mean, do our job.
More trash, less trash?
Trash.
Different trash?
Different trash around. You know, it's just like, I don't know. The only thing I can tell you is just the workplace. We just working. That's all, you know what I mean? To pay my bills.
And what shift do you work here? Are you here? I see you. I've seen you every day.
I'm here in the morning shift. Like, sometimes I used to come at like 6 to 2:30.
And have you watched any of the speeches that go on in the evening when you get home?
I watch it on the news.
Yeah. What do you think of them?
Good, you know what I mean? See what's going on in the world, you know what I mean? So, that's about it.
Hi, I'm sorry to interrupt. I wonder if I could ask either of you what it's been like to work this week, if it's been what you expected.
Sure. I'm
mid-bite, sorry.
Chewing breakfast. Hi, John Sinton.
And where are you from? Who are you? What do you do?
Oh, I'm from Atlanta, Georgia.
Wow.
I have a non-broadcast network called Progressive Voices. And we stream a series of progressive hosts and commentary.
And what has this week been like so far? What you expected, or?
I mean, physically, hell if you threw in a couple of ice cubes, because it's like a million degrees and really humid.
Wait, you're from Atlanta.
I know. It's hot. It's, trust me, it's hotter here than it is in D.C. or Atlanta. It's horrible. This week has been pretty much what I expected. A little easier to get around than it was last week in Cleveland.
Really? Because everyone was complaining that it's been more difficult here, but you found it easier.
Well, everything's self-contained. So we in Cleveland, where we were with the media was at the convention center, and then the queue was like a bus ride away and all that stuff. So this is kind of all right here. But that's small middle parts. Otherwise, everyone's been really cooperative, and I think so far it's a great week.
And it's only 8 a.m. Have you been here in the evenings as well?
Oh, yeah. That's why I look like this.
And that's it from Radio Row at the Democratic National Convention. At WHYY, Susan Greenbaum producing our coverage with assistance from Nick Kowalski and Madison Poulter and Kevin Griffin, our engineer. Down here at Radio Row, Adam Staniszewski, our engineer, and producers Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.